Oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 073015, United States of America versus Linwood Ashton Appellant. Ms. Stein for the appellant, Mr. Cooney for the appellee.
Ms. Stein, good morning.
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honor, counsel. My name is Cheryl Stein, and I represent appellant, Linwood Ashton. Excuse me, Your Honors, I'm recovering from a slight illness. I'm having a little trouble with my voice. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In this case, appellant submits that the trial court committed reversible error in denying his request either to call Officer David Adams as a witness to the stand or to present a copy of the executed PD-47, the Miranda rights card on which he refused to waive his rights. These two rulings, particularly in combination, deprived the defendant of his right to compulsory service under the Sixth Amendment and also constituted a due process violation under the Fifth Amendment. So it is appellant's position that this error needs to be analyzed under a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard set by Chapman v. California for errors of constitutional dimension. The government, in its brief, has relied extensively on the fact on what they allege is the fact that the defendant was negligent in getting this information. We vehemently dispute that. In the first place, Your Honors, the one document that was sent to me about the taking of the statement is included in appellee's record materials at tab E. And what it shows, it's a one-page document entitled Metropolitan Police Department Investigative Supplement Report, and it's dated 2/23/2006. And all it says on it is that the defendant was arrested, that he refused to waive his Miranda warnings, and the interview was discontinued. And then there's a note that says, one tape stored in the 1D detective's office and placed on the audio video log, one tape provided to arresting officers for papering, which certainly says that there are two tapes of the interview that existed. Despite the fact that this report was prepared on February 23, 2006, it was not faxed to me until October 5th of 2006. The government has not disputed that factual allegation and has not presented any evidence to contradict it.
I thought the point was that Adams' name was on the report.
I think that is part of the point, yes, Your Honor.
And therefore, because I thought the statement was made to the district court that counsel didn't know the name.
I did say that at one point, Your Honor, and that was a failure of recollection on my part when I said it. As I was about to lay out with the facts, this was faxed to me while I was in a trial in Superior Court. I have no staff. I saw the document. I saw that it said there was a tape, and I immediately left a voicemail for the assistant U.S. attorney saying I wanted a copy of the tape. It is true that his name is reflected on this piece of paper, and as I stood in court during trial, I did not recall that from having received it a week and a half earlier. It took 3 or 4 days for government counsel to get back to me and say, well, actually, no tapes existed at all because the machine was malfunctioning.
And so this was how many days before trial?
Less than 2 weeks, about 9 or 10 days, when I was still tied up in another case in Superior Court.
Did you alert the district court to all of this before the trial started?
No, I did not, Your Honor. Not before the trial started, that is correct. I did not bring it up until the middle of the trial, partly because there was information I wasn't aware of that made it relevant until the trial was underway. But when we're looking at a report that was prepared almost 8 months earlier and was not disclosed until 2 weeks before the trial, and then it was less than 2 weeks before the trial before I was informed that despite the fact that the report said there were two separate tapes, that in fact there were no tapes, it left me in a very difficult position. I perhaps did not do as much as I should have, and maybe I'll need to alert Mr. Ashton to the possibility of a 2255. My point, however, Your Honor, is at that point, even if you accept the government's contention that it's an abuse of discretion standard that the court should apply and not a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which we dispute, but even under an abuse of discretion standard, the court is required by all the case law to engage in some balancing, to ask how long the witness is unavailable, when he might be able to come to court. And as Your Honors know from the transcript, none of that occurred. There was just a summary.
Isn't that your burden to do?
How could I possibly know when a police officer with pneumonia is is going to be ready to come back to court. This was information the government had. And no, Your Honor, with respect, I would submit it was the trial judge's obligation to say to the government, when will he be better? All the cases relied on by the government in opposition talk about the defense failure to find their defense witnesses. This was a police officer. The government knew his illness. The government had been in touch with him, and the government presumably would have known how long it would be before he could come to court. And they provide.
All I want to be clear about is that the prosecutor said to the district court that she had informed defense counsel that the officer was on sick leave with pneumonia.
Yes.
Counsel could have called the officer. Is that not right?
I do not have a phone number for an individual officer. He's on sick leave. He's not at work. I don't have a home number. I don't have a cell phone number.
Right.
I had.
So then you would have had to rely, ask the prosecutor to call? I mean, all I'm saying is that the bare transcript we have, there's no indication that there was any request made of the prosecutor to proffer how long it would take before the officer would be available.
I tried to get that information from her informally, Your Honor. She would not discuss it with me, and I expected when I raised it with the court for the court to start some sort of inquiry, and I would have said I'd like a proffer on that. But as the transcript clearly shows, he just cut me off immediately, said we're not doing that, and moved on to something else. And this may be a small.
Let me ask you, let's assume, just for the sake of this question, that, your position is Adams would have said that your client said, I never said that the drugs were mine.
Yes.
Not that he denied the drugs were his, but that he never said the drugs were mine.
Yes.
So let's assume that that is exculpatory, and you needed it to, if Adams had testified and he'd said, no, he never said that to me, you would have been stuck with that answer, wouldn't you?
I might well have, unless I had been able through cross-examination to get him to say something inconsistent that would shed some doubt on that. I take Your Honor's point, and the government made a great deal out of this, saying that it wasn't actually exculpatory. I agree that we were not expecting him to say no, he denied possession of the drugs, but one of the strongest pieces of evidence the government had was the allegation that immediately upon being removed from the car, the defendant said, oh, those are mine, not his, referring to his passenger. And that was just said right there on the scene. The government is engaged in a tortured argument in its brief about how that was the result of long-term planning on his part because he thought that would make the officer go away. I submit that's a ridiculous argument. The point of introducing it would be to cast real doubt on the fact that he would have confessed like that on the scene when he wasn't willing to talk to any police officers back at the police station.
Was it clear to the district judge that what you believed Adams' testimony would be?
I said it very clearly on the record, Your Honor. I can't say whether he clearly understood it, but I said very clearly. Yes, it's absolutely in the record, and it's cited in both the briefs.
How would you have gotten it in? Isn't it inadmissible hearsay?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it is an admissible hearsay. I submit that it's it's a statement of independent legal significance, like an oral contract. It's not for the truth of the matter that he didn't say it. It's for the fact that it was inconsistent with what the other officer had said. And in a case where there was such an inconsistent jury verdict with a conviction on the PCP and a hung jury on the marijuana, even though the drugs were in the exact same location and the officer said both could be smelled, I submit that it's impossible to conclude that there was overwhelming evidence when the jury did not convict on all charges.
Well, your better tack was to cross-examine the officer, right?
Which officer?
Officer Pitts. That's your better tack. I mean, this is an out-of-court statement. It has the same, whether it's hearsay or not, it has the same problems of reliability that cause us to look skeptically at hearsay. Your best chance was on cross-examination of Pitts, and you didn't do much cross-examination of Pitts, did you?
Well, if you mean just on this one subject,
right?
Right,
on this subject, right, yeah.
No, I think that's correct because there's no way. I mean, he said, I heard it. If I said to him three times, he didn't really, did you? That would just get him to repeat the same answer. I had nothing to attack him with and thought that
even if you got this in, this isn't much to attack him with, right? I mean, there are plenty of reasons why Mr. Ashton would have come up with a different story later, aren't they?
I agree, Your Honor, and the government would have been free to argue those different theories, but in a case where the government has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and the jury verdict was inconsistent and they weren't persuaded on the marijuana, I submit that even a small error like that, an additional piece of evidence like that, could have made all the difference.
And you should have gone, you should have done more to get the witness if it was that critical to you.
Your Honor, obviously, the court has its opinion. I may have to advise Mr. Ashton then about a 2255. But with respect, I have to submit that I think this was a case of my not being able to win for losing no matter what I did. At one point, and it's cited in the government's brief at 260 of the transcript, I was asking about a radio run, and I got chastised for not having made a specific request for it, despite the fact that the government had said, this is complete jinx, and I was told that I should have made further inquiry to make sure it was really complete. These were the representations given to me by the government. It said there were videotapes. I find out at the last minute that there weren't. And I have no way of contacting this officer, especially when I'm tied up in another trial in Superior Court.
I want to ask you, so I'm clear about this. If you want to call a police officer as a witness, assume we don't have this sick aspect involved, what do you do?
Well, normally, Your Honor, I try to get an investigator to go down to the police station if I know which station they work at. I don't know if this is still true. Years ago, you were able to serve a subpoena at the police liaison office in Superior Court, and that is likely still available as a procedure. On the other hand, Your Honor, when I said to the judge I had no reason to ask for the radio run, when I had been told that the jinx was complete, he said to me, well, there usually is one. I have to say I've never tried a case before where the government did not bring every police officer who was involved in the arrest and processing of the defendant into court. It was reasonable for me to believe he would be there as a defense, as a government witness.
You're an experienced defense attorney. I mean, the government often doesn't bring everybody to court, at least on the transcripts I've seen, unless the person is sitting in the courtroom. I mean, you can't rely.
They often don't use them as witnesses, Your Honor, but they're almost always in court. As a matter of fact, there was another police officer I wanted to call, and I did, in fact, call. And he was not used by the government, but he was under subpoena and present, and I made it clear that I wanted him held as my potential witness. It wasn't that I engaged in an assumption, Your Honor, it's that this was dumped on me at the last moment, and it was a week and a half before the trial, while I was in another case, that I found out there were no videotapes. Based on the report given to me by the government, I had every reason to believe there would be a videotape of this. I couldn't use Mr. Cole to deny the on-scene statement because he invoked
his
Fifth Amendment.
I just need to be clear, at least the transcript I read, you never advised the district court prior to trial
that
you were stuck with these last-minute problems, and therefore you needed a continuance or something. You
that
went
is
to trial, and then in the middle of the trial, these problems came up.
That is correct, Your Honor. And if that is the factor that is of decisional weight to the court, then I think I did commit an effective assistance of counsel if that were to be the court's conclusion, and I would have to advise Mr. Ashton of that. I certainly did my best in this trial. If it fell short, then I'll have to accept the responsibility for that.
You're over your time. We'll give you a minute to reply.
Thank you.
Mr. Cooney? Is it correct that it is not clear from the record whether the passenger was ever charged?
That is correct. All right. On the face of the record, that is correct.
All right.
May it please the Court, J.P. Cooney on behalf of the United States with Elizabeth Trostman. First, Your Honors, I'd just like to respond to the argument about the standard of review. I think it's clear here that a non-constitutional harmless error, if it came to a harmless error analysis, would apply here because as this Court recently held in Lathurn, which I think is dispositive on this question, evidentiary decisions by the district court are governed by the general abuse of discretion rule, and that's what we're dealing with here.
The claim here was right to present a defense.
That is the claim here, a right to present a defense or a compulsory process claim. However, as Judge Kavanaugh made clear in Lathurn, is that oftentimes claims of this nature are couched in those constitutional words. However,
this is that type of case, however, is it? I mean, here the defendant says, I need a witness to present my defense.
If
this is not just a mere evidentiary issue.
I think it is a actually perhaps not an evidentiary issue, but it's an issue as to whether a continuance or a delay was warranted. But it's not a compulsory process issue because here the defense made no efforts to make this witness available for trial. And I think, you know, going to the diligence prong of Neufeld, which is one of the considerations, just to make sure the timeline is clear, I think as appellant has conceded, this information was available on October 5, the name of Detective Adams. If it was 3 or 4 days later, which this is clear from the record, not just from argument, but 3 or 4 days later that the knowledge about the lack of a videotape was made clear, then it would have been October 9th. And that was a full 9 days before trial. Now, appellant has argued that the government hasn't cited a single case where, with comparable facts, instead relying on the argument that those are cases where the defense simply could not find their witnesses. But the government did cite one case, Natvig, which has almost precisely the same facts, which is a case where a mid-trial delay was not granted. And one of the considerations that the court made was this was a government witness who had had a heart attack and was therefore unavailable. But there was nothing in the record to substantiate that the appellant or the defendant had ever even spoken to that witness or made effort to speak to this witness. And here, we're in the exact same situation, where there are no pretrial efforts and no during trial efforts to either get this witness there, to make contact with this witness, or to serve a subpoena on this witness. So in such an instance, I don't think that the constitutional standard would apply. And then secondly, just simply on the abuse of discretion standard, appellant has not met his burden to establish that he exercised the proper due diligence.
Do we know why the district court wouldn't allow the Miranda card to be used?
I don't think that on the face of the record it's clear. I do think that the district court did just deny it. However, I think one of the problems in the
record. What are we supposed to do in a case like that? How do we review that decision if he didn't give us any reason for it?
Well, I think there are arguments concerning it in the record that the court can review, and because it is a discretionary standard, simply failing to state those specific reasons when the defense has not stated any foundation on which it could come in, the court can simply review what is in the record on that and the arguments that were made. And as we've argued in our brief, the PD-47, first, there was no foundation identified for how it would have come into evidence.
What do you mean, no foundation?
Well, it's not.
What defense counsel explained why she wanted the card in.
Yes, why, the purpose, but how it would have come into evidence.
What do you mean?
Through what witness? The PD-47 is a document, but it's there. But what it is and how it would be authenticated and come in.
Who would she have had to call to get the card in?
Presumably, I'm not certain, but presumably Detective Adams, because Detective Adams, on the basis of the supplemental record, tab E.
If Detective Adams is not available, who else would she have had to call to get the card in your view?
I'm not sure that there's another witness who could get it in. Unless there was another exception.
Adams or nothing.
I think that's right.
All right.
Well, isn't there a custodian?
For the 47?
Mm-hmm.
To get it in under a business record exception?
A police's record, yeah.
I suppose that there could be. I think that might be one way in which it could come into evidence. That's true. I think if the proper foundation for a business record could come in. But I think that.
Why wouldn't it? I just don't understand the nature of this objection at all.
That why the 47 would not come in?
Yeah.
Well, what I'm arguing is really.
There are reasons that the district court wanted to keep it out, but I just don't understand some of your arguments.
Well, I suppose my point is that on the face of the record, to put anything into evidence, certainly the proponent of that evidence bears the burden to show that it's admissible. And all I'm arguing is on the basis of this record, I don't think that we can say that there was a foundation for it presented to the district court. But apart from that, Judge Griffith, to your question about the reasons, I think it's also clear there was a proffer made to the district court as to the purpose that it was going in, and the PD-47 simply was not relevant. It did not make it more or less probable that the statement on the scene was made.
But the district court didn't state that, right? The district court didn't give a reason for that.
No, the district court did not state that, and the government did cite in its brief cases, specifically Gloucester, where the district court did not make a complete record of its reasons, but first where the defendant or appellant did not ask for a statement of reasons to make that record clear and did not provide a clear record himself as for the basis for admitting it or for the reason for admitting it, then the district court cannot be said to have abused its discretion by denying the request. But even if...
Did you make any objection on the record? I can't remember. When she wanted the PD-47, what did the government do?
Actually, the government's objection ran specifically to Detective Adams' testimony,
okay,
and just on hearsay grounds and a sword and a shield argument. But no, there was not. The government did not make a specific argument with respect to the PD-47
itself.
So that
makes it even harder for us to figure out why the judge said no.
Yes.
Because you had no position or took no position.
That's correct. The government took no position below. But I think even if setting all of that aside, I think the real point about both Detective Adams' testimony and the PD-47 is that, and actually with respect to Detective Adams' testimony, I do need to say one more thing, is that it's not altogether clear, or that the proffer of what he would have testified to is not corroborated by anything in the record. And as this court made clear in Poston, the defense does bear some burden, particularly when you have a missing witness like this, to show that, to not make mere assertions, as the court couched it.
Well, the government destroyed the tapes, all right? I mean, I'm not saying the government did it nefariously, but the tapes would have been presumably corroborative evidence. The only other corroborating witness is the defendant, and he has a constitutional right not to testify.
But that's precisely why the defense bears a burden of diligence to investigate.
That's a different argument.
I think so, except that they run together, which is to say that corroboration or that ability to support the proffer for what Detective Adams would have stated, that would have been solved had the due diligence been exercised to obtain his presence at trial. Now, I think either way, though, the real bottom line about this is that even assuming for the sake of argument that that is how Detective Adams would have testified, is that none of this, neither his testimony nor the PD-47, accounts for all of the other evidence presented at trial, which was significant in several of the cases the government cited in Haldeman, in Poston, in Gant and Hayes, that this did not account for the strong smell that the officers testified to, the volume of PCP, the prior times that the defendant had been seen in the vehicle by Officer Pitts, and which was corroborated by the defense's own testimony from Crystal Perry, Anthony McFadder's girlfriend, his link as a cousin to Anthony McFadder. All of that other evidence would not have been accounted for by this simple testimony from Detective Adams or from the PD-47.
Countered by, exactly.
That testimony would not have taken on any of that evidence. The only evidence it would have taken on was the one statement on the scene, "That's mine, not his," for which there was argument at trial about the reasons why the defendant may have made a statement.
Your argument has to be there was overwhelming evidence that he constructively possessed the PCP.
That is our argument, that there was overwhelming other evidence for which this evidence, the statement, would not have taken on or given any explanation for. So the only issue would have taken account
for. That's hard for me. So you're making the point that had there not been this statement about this confession of possession, that the jury still would have come out the way that it did. Given the way it's splintered on some of the other on possession of some of the other things that were in the automobile, that's a hard argument to make, isn't it?
I see my time has expired. May I respond to that? Thank you. I don't think so, actually. I think that to the extent that that the verdicts were different, actually it may support this argument. Because what's important here is that the jury actually hung on the quid marijuana count. The marijuana was found in that black bag for which he said that's mine, not his, on the scene. But the jury convicted on the quid PCP, which was all of the 220 milliliters, or the more than $11,000 worth of PCP, in the hatchback of the car. That was the PCP that was smelling so strong that the officers had to close the windows.
How much marijuana was there?
Your Honor, I apologize. I can't remember the exact amount of marijuana.
Are you sure? My memory was that the marijuana was in the trunk. Am I wrong on that?
No, the marijuana was in the black bag that was found underneath the front passenger seat.
Okay.
The heroin, which was what he was acquitted of, was found under the gear shift. So heroin in the gear shift, marijuana in the black bag. And there were vials found in the black bag which had PCP residue.
Right, I understand all of that, but if there was just a smattering of marijuana, I'm just trying to understand, you know, how much marijuana was there?
Oh, how much? I see, Your Honor, and I apologize. I do not know right offhand. I can check the record, but I think that in addition to the volume of marijuana, there was...
I'd like to know where in the record it tells us. I think your counsel is...
In the record and in the transcript of 10-18-06, which is underneath of tab G, 99.8 grams of marijuana. That's at pages 220 to 22 and 326 to 27.
I'm sorry, 99 grams?
99.8 grams of marijuana. And there were also...
That was in the bag.
That was in the bag. That is correct. If there are no other questions, Your Honor, ask that the district court be affirmed.
Oh, I just want to be clear from your reading of the record. These two types of drugs were mixed in one bag?
In the black bag in the front? The marijuana and the PCP you're talking about?
That's what you're telling me.
Yes. There was in the black bag that was found in the front passenger seat. I'm sorry if I'm not being clear.
They were just mixed together?
Oh, no, no. There were vials that were found which had PCP residue. And separate from that, there was marijuana, the 99.8 grams of marijuana that I just said.
So there was only residue of PCP?
Found in the black bag.
And so what was in the bag was the marijuana?
Correct.
And these vials with traces of residue of PCP?
Correct. And the lion's share of the PCP, the more than $11,000 worth, was found in the compartment in the hatchback.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government would ask that the court affirm the ruling of the district court.
All right. Ms. Stein, why don't you take a minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I have several points, but the most urgent one is about the marijuana, given the court's questions. Government counsel is entirely incorrect in what he said, and it's odd because he states it correctly in his brief. The only thing that was in the black bag that was found in the passenger compartment was an Altoid tin with some vials inside that had a small amount of yellowish liquid and a large number of empty Ziploc bags. All of the marijuana was taken out of the jack area in the hatchback, which is exactly where the two bottles of PCP were found. That's contained at pages 220, 221, and 222 of the transcript. And on page 4 of the government's brief, where they correctly state, officers recovered a second black bag from the hatchback compartment, which contained 99.8 grams of marijuana. The marijuana was with the bulk of the PCP. They were right next to each other, physically adjacent, so that it is an inconsistent jury verdict to determine that he was guilty of possession of one and not of the other. The passenger was never charged. There was never a co-defendant in this case. The court had asked about that. Mr. Cole was certainly not charged in district court. Whether there were charges in superior court, I don't know about. My understanding was he was never charged at all. He was appointed counsel when I brought him to court and tried to present him as a witness. An assistant federal defender interviewed him, and through counsel, he asserted his Fifth Amendment right and refused to testify. And the PD-47 admitting that is not a discretionary ruling. That is the defendant's right to present a defense. It implicates due process. It's not discretionary. And I would disagree that there is a custodian of records that could have been used. First of all, I do not believe this is a business record under the exception to hearsay because it's prepared in anticipation of litigation. It is kept in each separate file. I do not believe there is any central place where they are held. And I would also submit that the government... Each individual officer, I believe, keeps the files for his cases and, of course, turns it over the original to the U.S. Attorney's office when it comes to paper because the original is always in the assistant U.S. Attorney's jacket. And I would submit that there would be no need to authenticate or provide a foundation for a document that the government gave to me in discovery. So they represented in discovery that this was an authentic document, and I would submit they would have been stopped from denying that at the trial since they were the source of the material. And of course, this is not a missing witness issue, Your Honor. Missing witness is when the witness is peculiarly available to one side. This was a police officer who was much more available to the government than the defense, although certainly not unavailable. And I will also note this, Your Honor, because I've run into this before. When one serves a subpoena on the police department, whether it's for an individual or for a document, and I'm talking now about defense lawyers, the police department won't even comply with it until they check with the U.S. Attorney's Office about whether they should or not. I have served subpoenas and been told in response, we're waiting for authorization from the U.S. Attorney's Office to comply with your subpoena, which I think is a clearly unconstitutional practice. But it does make it more difficult. It is not like one can just find a police officer in a couple of days' notice. And I would also submit that the absence of any reasons for excluding the PD 47, as well as no discussion about Detective Adams, no findings of fact, show that discretion was not exercised in the way it is to be exercised, even if the court concludes that this was a discretionary decision. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, will you call the next case?
Case number 07.